but every holiday nobody.
All right, back on the Jeff Dawkins Show. Let's do this Chris Harrington deal.
Now it's Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian on the Grizzlies and Beyond. Every weekday around 10 a.m. Brought to you by the attorneys of Thomas White and Gill. Find them online at memphisfamilylaw.com.
Chris Harrington joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
That's Family Business by Kanye West. Kanye, born on this day in 1977. To quote a different Kanye West song, I prefer the old Kanye.
Kanye tried to join a protest over the weekend, and I gather it didn't go well, and so he left. He created too much of a hubbub. Okay, I want to talk to you about the protest. I gather you were at the protest Saturday night. Before we do that, is there anything else we've learned about the NBA and the Memphis Grizzlies as they head into this next phase?
Unless I missed something, they haven't put out the schedule officially yet. There's a lot of conversation. I mean, there's still so much stuff being worked out with the players' union and with the teams in terms of the specifics. And I think they're sort of working out roster rules. You know, are two-way players allowed to play? Are they eligible? Can you sign new players? Once the thing starts, can you still sign players if you have, you know, players out with coronavirus? And if you can, who can you sign? Who can you not sign? A lot of that's being worked out. I think they clarified, which I feel like I sort of already knew this or assumed it. They clarified that, like, tiebreakers that standings will be by winning percentage, right? And so because teams have played an uneven amount of games, like two teams can both be three games back in a one loss in a games behind column, but one team is slightly ahead of the other in a percentage. And so the winning percentage is going to determine standings. I think that came out.
There are three teams tied behind the Grizzlies: Sacramento, Portland, and New Orleans. And we talk a lot about New Orleans, mostly because New Orleans in the old world had the easiest schedule, and New Orleans was playing Memphis twice and had beaten them twice. And so New Orleans sort of looked like the most formidable competitor. Although, honestly, Sacramento, I think, heading into the break, was playing the best basketball at that point. Is there one of these teams that, if you were to pick one of those three teams to emerge as the most likely to be the ninth seed, which would it be? And is there one of those teams that you would prefer the Grizzlies to play if they do get to the 8-9 series?
I guess I would go New Orleans as the biggest threat, because I think, you know, if you reset everything, I think that's probably the best team, and I think they are likely to have a somewhat easier schedule than the rest. So I guess that would be my answer to that. You know, the Grizzlies have looked pretty good, or did look pretty good against the Blazers. The Blazers will likely be getting back two of their big men who have been out, and Yusuf Nurkic and Zach Collins. But from a matchup standpoint, I'd prefer to play the Blazers than the Pelicans or the Kings.
Right. Okay. It'll be so we need to – really the main thing we want to know is the schedule. And we honestly think we know that. Do we think we know that for the Grizzlies? We think it's going to be the schedule that they would have.
If they proceed, yeah, it seems likely the Grizzlies – and the Grizzlies may be alone in this, I'm not sure, that they would have the schedule that they had. It seems pretty clear that the NBA is going to follow the schedule as it existed, but tweak it to make it work. And it is not clear what the order of operations are for how you decide to tweak it and to make it fit. But pretty much any way you do it, like, those things probably won't impact the Grizzlies, because their next eight games were all against teams that are quote-unquote inside the bubble.
Okay. Moving on to the issue of the protests. You were there Saturday night. There were multiple protests Saturday night, right? You were at one of them?
There's been multiple protests pretty much every night. Yeah. And so there is no such thing as the protest in Memphis.
Right.
You know, there's different pockets of activity from different people in different places all over the city. There was stuff in Millington and Hernando and Collierville. Yeah.
Which were you? Where were you?
I followed one in Midtown on Saturday night that went from Overton Park through Overton Square and parts of Midtown and back to Overton Park.
Okay. And that was the one where a driver drove into the protest, yes?
No, that was the night before. That was on Friday night also in Midtown.
Yeah, I knew that was. And describe, how many people were there? What was the scene?
I'm bad at estimating crowds. I would say a couple hundred, 200 to 300 maybe, seemed about right. And it was led by a woman, I believe named L.J. Abram, and it was a typical, protest march. You're marching with signs and chanting. It stopped traffic in several places. On Poplar, and then it stopped a couple times right in the middle of Overton Square at Cooper and Madison, went across Union, circled around. It was fairly brief, as these things have been, because it was really, really hot, and there was sort of an acknowledgement of that. It interacted with there were lots of people who were eating outside at restaurants in Overton Square, at Lafayette's, at Local, and at Side Street Grill. I saw lots of people coming, obviously people just sort of gawking and like trying to figure out what was going on, but there was lots of cheering and clapping. I didn't see any, at least on Saturday night, any pushback from anybody. When it circled back around and came up Cooper, Kelly English, who I know, was out handing out water in front of Second Line. I also saw people, I think the owner, but I wasn't entirely sure because it was sort of all happening fast. But I saw people from Bari also come out to give water to people as they were walking by.
You did discuss a piece. Chris has a piece up at the Daily Memphian, which I urge you to read. And you talked about the different factions of protests, the different protests, which are being led by different people. And they're not 100%. They're obviously all moving towards common goals, but in different ways, with different approaches, et cetera. I sort of wrote the one that I followed the other night was the Devante Hill-led one. And then you had people splintering off from that, calling him a fraud because he's cooperative with the police, et cetera, it appears, or whatever. That was their impression. How would you characterize you call them factions, the different factions here?
Yeah, I mean, I just think there's no leader of the protests in Memphis. The mayor and the police chief have sort of declared Devante Hill and to a lesser degree Frank Gotti as the leaders of the protests in Memphis. And that's just not, it's not what is happening in Memphis, and I think it's happening in just almost every other city too, are not centralized things with individual leaders. It's just not that. I mean, Devante Hill is doing a very specific thing that is pretty, he's been doing it just about every night. It's very similar. I've done it twice. I followed him twice and followed him from a distance, other nights. And it's a very similar, it's not exactly the same, but it's a similar kind of thing. It almost feels like a show that's having an extended run. Like, the Orpheum to see Hamilton for 2 weeks in a row, you can go downtown and do the Devante Hill March. It really is sort of almost feels like that kind of thing. It's a very similar arc. It starts the same place, ends the same place, it's sort of a different kind of thing a little bit, I think, than what you're seeing with a lot of these other sort of flare-up situations around the city. But I don't, I've been critical of city leaders' sort of desire to anoint Devante Hill as the leader of the protests in Memphis, which I don't think is an accurate assessment. But also, I just think ultimately that almost is less important, like who they meet with, who they don't, than like what's going to happen from a policy standpoint, which is, I think, where we're headed. And I think that's going to be a much trickier conversation to have for the community than do we believe Black Lives Matter, which I hope, some people push back at that, but I think, I think somewhat, to some degree, that's an easier thing to say than whatever your preferred policy position is, which I think people there'll be more natural complication and disagreement when you get into that.
Well, and let's be honest, it has ever been thus in the 1960s. It wasn't everyone behind Martin Luther King Jr. There were other approaches then as well, and other people. There is no president of a protest, as you point out, in terms of the this being translated into policy. What does that look like? How does that even happen?
We don't know what it looks like. It could look like all kinds of different things. in terms of how things happen, I mean, some things can be just decisions strictly within the mayor's office and the police department in terms of changing their policies. Some things, especially that are funding related, are going to, you know, involve the city council, or if you're talking about the Shelby County Sheriff's Office, it'll involve the Shelby County Commission. And, you know, it's those processes are like processes on anything else. In terms of what people are going to want to see, I mean, I think we had a good op-ed this weekend at the Daily Memphian from Bryce Ashby and Steve Mulroy, who are local attorneys, and they had three very specific things that they called for, which I think are all reasonable and probably more doable than a lot of other things that are being called for.
And what were those things?
They called for strengthening what is called the civilian, CLRB. I'm going to mess it up, CLRB, is Civilian Law Enforcement Review Board, which is basically to give the civilian oversight group more power, particularly subpoena power. Second thing they called for is demilitarizing our police forces. That's something, I mean, Montana, the state of Montana, which is not a liberal bastion, is already doing this statewide. There was a real move, you know, post 9/11, which is 20 years ago, I guess at this point, a lot of police departments around the country sort of ramped up, you know, their what they had in terms of their physical, you know,
their armaments, for heaven's sake.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Struggling for word, and so you had a lot of really military grades. Equipment that sort of got built up around local law enforcement. And I think there's a lot of interest really across the ideological divide to take a close look at that and maybe start to wind some of that back a little bit. So that's one of the things they brought up. And then the other thing they brought up, which I also think you can get a lot of agreement about, is changing the way police officers are trained toward de-escalating situations. And so I think those three things that those two attorneys suggest, which they call it a radical rethinking, I actually don't think is that radical. I think there, you can find a lot of agreement across the board on those three things. I think when you get into...
Radical is what's happening in Minneapolis, where they're going to, quote-unquote, defund the police department, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the stuff that gets really complicated, because people hear that and they think anarchy, but that's not really what it means. And I think when you hear about defund or especially abolish, those are slogans, but what those things actually mean in practical terms gets really complicated, and I think different people who throw those words around actually mean different things by them. And that's the stuff that I think gets way more complicated.
Yeah. It will certainly be jumped on by opponents. What, defund the police? That's anarchy. The truth is, in Minneapolis, where they're thinking about this or whatever, what the point is that if you look at the vast majority of police calls, they involve mental health. They involve health issues. They involve
drug issues that are not related to trafficking or whatever. Yeah.
A small minority of the calls they get are actual sort of violent criminal issues, right? And so is there a different way and a better way, rather than, you know, arming the police to send them everywhere, to handle creating peace in American cities or fostering peace in American cities or solving problems in throughout the country? And that's sort of what they're looking at. It's easily turned into a ridiculous slogan, who wants anarchy? But yeah, we don't need to get into all of that today. You do bring up that the mayor of Memphis, he did meet with Devante Hill and Frank Gotti. The mayor of Memphis was actually elected not long ago on a platform of more police, not less police, not diminishing the way, not talking about the way the police interact with the community, but law and order and more police was basically what it felt like Strickland ran on.
Yeah, so that's why I think we have to be careful. There's a tide sort of across the country right now, or a lot of energy around police reform. But I think we have to be careful assuming that because that's where the noise is, that's where the people are. And it, to me, it is not at all clear what the people of Memphis writ large want to do on these issues, or whether their collective opinion has shifted. And maybe it has, but I don't think we can just assume that. Yeah.
Right. Okay. A couple more things you mentioned in the piece. One is the protests in Memphis appears, certainly looking at Nashville, which we like to all the time, Nashville and Memphis, smaller
I mean, look at Buffalo.
There was a huge trigger incident in Buffalo.
Right.
So there
right.
wasn't really such a trigger incident in Nashville. I think Buffalo's kind of in response to it's one of the main focuses. But yes, lots of places, they're bigger. And you have thoughts on why
not,
that might
this
be.
Is not, this is not unusual. This is the same thing was true, you know, when the Women's March happened around the country, when the immigration marches happened around the country. Memphis has not been prone to sort of mass demonstrations along these issues or any other. Honestly, the same thing was true of, you know, there was the wave around the country of the anti-shutdown protests. Like, I went down to the Memphis anti-shutdown protests. There were more media there than protesters. There was four people down there. And so, like, Memphis is just, for whatever reason, and I'm not saying this is, you know, inherently good or bad, although I do think it indicates something about the population. Memphis has not been prone to, like, showing up in mass for much of anything, really. Compared to other cities,
right? Some of it you think it's a luxury. I mean, we are not a. I don't know. What did you observe of the demographics of the folks who were at the protest? Does there need to be wealth in a city to you said it could be some measure of the health of a city.
Yeah, I mean, I made the same point when the Women's March, Immigration March stuff happened, because I at that time there was sort of data out there of sort of, you know, march size in different places. And if you looked at, like, that data and you compared it to a totally separate list, which was fastest-growing cities in the country, you saw that there was an overlap between the two things. Whether that's causal or just a correlation is sort of a different question. But there was a correlation between, like, the cities that had the highest per capita attendance at, I can't remember whether this was the Women's March or the Immigration March I looked at. That was a few years ago. But there was a correlation between the highest per capita attendance at those events and the list of the country's fastest growing cities. And what I surmise from that in part is that the people who are most likely to turn out at these things tend to be younger, tend to be, you know, well-educated college students, recent college grads, don't necessarily tend to be well-off, but tend to be sort of young, engaged, educated people, which happen to be the same population groups that cities are seeking to attract and retain. And so there is, it's sort of a complicated point or observation, but there is to a degree, I think, to which, you know, masses of that population both sort of, you know, is what fuels, you know, demonstrations, and it's also what fuels growth. I mean, it's a little bit of an ironic thing, but I think there's something to that.
Yeah. Okay, and finally, you had a piece Friday that I did not talk to you about, which was about, in all of this, and I'm going to talk to my buddy Charles Fishburne in the next segment about this, COVID-19 hasn't gone away. And you are not someone who says, gatherings on the beach were dangerous, and gatherings for a protest, totally cool and not dangerous. There is an issue here of making choices and decisions, and we do still need to be cautious. What are your thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I think I'm the only person I've seen who's written in any way to say, hey, wait a minute, like, you know, these protests could be COVID spreading situations. And I've still, like, my email is full of people calling me a hypocrite because, like, you know, oh, you're okay with it when the protest. And, like, I think I've been fairly consistent on this stuff. That was sort of the point. Like, I do not approve. Like, to me, everything we're doing is a sort of a value risk assessment, right? To the degree that, like, we have a choice. And so to me, like, the Devontae Hill thing where he brings people in under the train overpass and they huddle together closely and they chant together, to me, like, the risk is way greater than the value in that moment. And so, like, I don't think you're gaining as much from, you know, your message spreading as you are probably from your COVID spreading and then that particular situation. I ultimately think that, A, you know, like I said, everything's a value risk assessment, and we have to acknowledge that there is risk. There's value and there's risk, and you make those assessments. But I don't think, from a public health standpoint, we should change the information we give and the risk profiles we give based on what the nature of the activity.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it. His piece is up at the Daily Memphian. You can read it now. Thanks, Chris.
Don't miss the Jeff Calkins Show tomorrow at 9 a.m. on 92.9 FM ESPN.